This is day one of this July 2016 7-day session. And we'll start this session with readings from a book called The Original Face, which is an anthology of Rinzai Zen, or to use his actual Chinese name, Lin Chi Zen. And I'm just going to select the teachings of Zen Master Bunan. This is a Japanese text. All the masters in here are Japanese, but they place themselves in the lineage of Chinese Zen Master Lin Chi, who they renamed Rinzai. Bunan is a short biographical piece on Bunan. He's from the 1600s. He's trained for some 30 years under the guidance of the famous national teacher Gudo, who was considered the true lamp of the generation spanning war and peace. By the way, this book was translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. So many of the texts that we read from in Taisho, they come from periods of warfare. Almost all of it is domestic warfare, civil wars in China as well as Japan. So this was a period of mixed war and peace in these 1600s. It says here, Bunan was a layman until his 40s, working as a gatekeeper, and there he used to talk to this great master Gudo, who would stop there on his travels, crossing over Japan west and east. Later, Bunan left home and became a monk and an abbot of a small hermitage, which was historically the foremost of Gudo's 24 successors. He had a few disciples, close disciples, and a wide range of disciples and acquaintances. He left a great deal of inspiration and guidance in Japanese poetry and booklets in prose and verse. Says he was naturally austere. He led his group with a few simple rules. And it says that he couldn't even read the difficult Chinese classic texts. That's all we have on this Bunan. And now some selections of his teachings here. He starts off with just a very short piece. It is easy to keep things at a distance. It is hard to be naturally beyond them. So he's talking about the difference between avoiding temptations and transcending them. So if you know that you have an attachment to the internet, then it's easier to just steer clear of your smartphone or your computer, just go on a fast, an internet fast. It's easier to do that than to use it moderately, sensibly. It's easier to be to avoid it altogether. And that's what we find in Sesshin. This is the one of the advantages of the monastic calling is that historically, anyway, when you took lifelong vows of celibacy, then you just were not in the company of women. And that made it easier to deal with sexual cravings. And you could fill in the blank here, any kind of craving. If you have a craving for ice cream, then it's easier to keep it out of the house than it is to have it in the house and have it in moderation, just on occasion. Fill in the blank. Whatever your attachment is, the monks don't risk these temptations because life is so simple, just as it is for us in Sesshin. We have really no ability to get involved in things that we're attached to, things like that, other than our thoughts. We can always get plenty involved with our thoughts. But refraining from getting involved in unwholesome or unhealthy things is a great help in developing, leading an upright life. But there's a strength that we lay people have that comes from having to grapple with our attachments, and in that way to learn, without avoiding them entirely, learn how to use things rather than being used by them. Both have their advantages. To come to Sesshin and not have the option of fleeing into whatever one's cravings are can be quite illuminating and helpful in concentrating on practice alone and not having the mind scattered in this way or that way. And these cravings often are themselves a way to avoid the great matter. The great matter of birth and death. But then that kind of strength is based on conditions being arranged just so. And we don't have to really develop the self-discipline, the self-restraint that lay people do. I've told the story of when I was at a Zen temple in Japan, and is very strict in terms of rules and limitations. So you're expected to stay in the monastery. In order to leave, go outside the gates of the temple, you'd have to get permission from the Roshi there. If you wanted to buy some razors, razor blades to shave with, you'd have to go to him and get permission, and then only then go to town. And I was told when I was there that there are 3 or 4 days of the year when the monks were allowed, or the trainees, let's call them what they really were. These are not monks in the old sense of having taken vows of lifelong celibacy, but they were leading monastic life there in the temple. And three or four times a year, Tungan Roshi would just say, take off, have a good time. It's, when I was there, it was a beautiful spring day, and he just said, take the afternoon off, have fun. And I was quite taken aback at how childishly these young trainees acted when they got outside. They were gorging themselves on junk food from stores and running around acting like monkeys and silly. And it was quite a demonstration of the limits of physical restraints, of the limits of monastic training. At the, at our own center, we've always had this hybrid where people in residential training, people who live at the center, have the freedom to go out during break periods and weekends, to go out and enjoy the pleasures of the Saha world. And that has its weaknesses, because people can then find all kinds of things to spend time doing away from the center in town rather than sitting. But it also has its, in having its those challenges, it can help us really integrate the discipline rather than relying completely on the venue of the center itself. His next little statement here is, while deluded, one is used by this body. When enlightened, one uses this body. One is used by this body. Here too, more about cravings, craving for food, sex, sleep. When enlightened, and here he's talking about true realization, then one can use these things as in accordance with one's circumstances. But also, emotional states, when deluded, one is whipped around, tossed around by one's fear or anxiety, one's anger. But if we stick with this long enough, we learn to use anger, feelings of anger. How do you do that? Well, first of all, it starts with noticing the anger. A lot of people, when they're angry, don't know it. As strange as that may sound. So to learn to detect the signs of rising anger, pulse quickening, maybe the hands perspiring, a catch in the throat, other kinds of perspiration, then once we learn to see these things and realize, okay, I'm getting angry, now we have a chance of working with that, those feelings of anger. And that doesn't mean venting. It means having noticed it, then we have a chance to choose. We can choose how to react to the circumstances or the person who we see as provoking our anger. It's a huge, huge, monumental difference that comes just from noticing it, noticing as it comes on. That creates, the noticing is the space that enables us to make it, to choose how to respond to the situation, to the person. Another passage here where Bunan said, to let the body be free and not to cling to anything. For this reason, it is a great matter. Thus, it is a rare thing in this age. To let the body be free. Well, this goes back to what he had just said, and not to be used by the body and its blind passions and emotional storms, not to be used, but to be free, again, to respond to these inevitable, these things, this anger and emotions and cravings that come up, and not to cling to anything, not to cling to our anger, not to cling to our sadness or even depression, not to make a big story about our anxieties. How do we avoid doing that? By not clinging to our thoughts. It's natural enough to feel frightened at times, to feel anxiety in certain situations. But dwelling in our thoughts about the source of our anxiety, this then binds us to that anger. So, to take a very simple, common example, feeling anxious about going to Doksan, who doesn't feel at least some faint anxiety about going to Doksan? I did for many years. But then if we are dwelling in our thoughts about what might happen in Doksan, what the teacher might say, what we might say, and whatever. By dwelling in those thoughts, then we bind ourselves to the anxiety. Or the anxiety about something that we're afraid, something coming up, some test or report we have to give, a meeting that we have to be part of. Dwelling in thoughts about it is what sustains the anxiety. There's not that much we can do about when the anxiety just arises on its own. This is part of being human. There are times when we have anxiety or fear, but we can do something about the extent to which we wallow in that anxiety or fear. Skipping through a few paragraphs here, you should always act with kindness and compassion. People think that kindness and compassion mean doing things, but actually giving people things is the foremost kindness and compassion. Giving people things. Well, we have our eighth of the ten cardinal precepts, not to withhold spiritual or material aid, but to give them freely where needed. This is something we can address on a practically a daily basis. There's so many opportunities for giving money, so many causes that we can give money to, but giving also means giving in meetings with people, interacting with people, giving our attention, listening, truly listening, thoroughly listening to someone is a very high form of giving. Zazen is a form of giving, because it is the ultimate giving up. Giving up our thoughts, our attachments to our thoughts, the thought of self, self and other. This is arguably the most difficult giving and the most powerful giving, what we're doing this week, around the clock practically. It's just a week of dana, of giving, generosity, to the degree that we're willing to give up our thoughts as they arise, let go of them, return the mind to the practice. Every time we redirect our attention to the breath or to the koan, whatever it is we're working on, every time we do that, we're giving. He continues, fire is something that burns, water is something that wets, a Buddha is someone who practices compassion. Remember that Buddha simply means awakening or the awakened one. A Buddha is someone who practices compassion. Teaching people to be kind and compassionate to others means imitating the Buddha. That is, upholding our Buddha nature. And that means living in accordance with the precepts. That's upholding our Buddha nature when we uphold the precepts. He says, if you just practice compassion, you will certainly become good. The basis of compassion is purity of the mind. Purity of the mind is, quote, not a single thing. That is, a mind free of thoughts. Not a single thing means nothing at all. It is beyond the reach of speech, beyond affirmation and negation. If there is any affirmation or negation in your heart, it will be obstructed by that affirmation and negation. If there is no affirmation or negation, then heaven and earth are one. If there is something, it separates you from heaven. This you should well understand. So I'm going to pick one sentence here. He said, the basis of compassion is purity of the mind. What does he mean? There is a form of Buddhist meditation called metta, M-E-T-T-A, metta meditation. Metta means loving kindness, where you endeavor to generate and radiate loving kindness. You do this through the use of words or images, and you direct this loving kindness. You can direct it first to yourself and then to others. And it works. It's a valid practice. I first found out about this and used it as an antidote to anger. When you're having feelings of hostility to someone, you can employ this practice of metta meditation and can neutralize the hostility in no time, especially if your mind has been trained in concentration. anything we do with greater concentration is going to be more effective. So with a basis of Zen concentration, to bring in a practice of metta meditation can be very powerful. But it's not Zen in the orthodox sense, in the traditional sense. In Zen, it's a whole different premise. The premise is that by emptying the mind of thoughts and concepts, we liberate our innate loving kindness. Not right away. It may not happen for years in any really noticeable way, but it will happen if we persist in daily sitting. Then we find that we respond more readily out of our innate compassion, our innate loving kindness. So in other words, rather than trying to generate a state of mind such as loving kindness, we just we avoid dwelling in the thoughts that block that loving kindness from functioning freely. It's just two different methods. One appeals to some people more than the other. Sometimes the very intention of being good can get us into trouble. Trying to impose imposing our ideas of what's good, what's virtuous, and that can be problematic. I've heard that there have been studies that show that people who have bumper stickers are more likely to get into road rage, no matter what the bumper sticker says. Give peas a chance. You're more likely to get into road rage. You know the other ones. We've seen them all by Thich Nhat Hanh and others. And then he offers this verse. I don't know if it's, never know with these masters whether it's their own verse or whether it's of a previous master. But he says, the mind which knows nothing is a Buddha by a different name. It's pure Zen. You could say that every Zen practice, whether it's a breath or a koan or shikantaza, what they all have in common is that they open the doors to a state of not knowing. And in that not knowing, we're free. We're unbound by our knowledge, our thoughts, our opinions. He continues, since you will surely eventually die, you should set your mind diligently on the way of enlightenment. There's a Chinese proverb, discipline begins with the fear of death. That may be what brought all of us to the Sesshin. The awareness of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. That we're like fish in a pond that is being constantly drained. He continues, there is no enlightened Buddha outside your own heart. Always keep a pure and clean mind and heart. When thoughts of your own body come up, as long as such thoughts are always there, this life lasts but a little while, and you will fall into a hell and suffer forever and ever. But even leaving that aside, in this life you will suffer in many ways. Anyone who has difficulty with the word hell can need only think of it as a hellish state, falling into hellish states, which we know happen in this very life to all too many people. Here's a section, he says, things people are always wrong about. So the first, hating to be fooled by others while liking to be fooled by oneself. Here he's talking about our capacity for self-deception. And the longer we practice, the more humbling it is to see how willing we are to deceive ourselves. It's nothing better than Zen practice for coming to see the tricks we play, the ways in which we let ourselves off the hook, the rationalizations. Second one. Knowing others die, but not realizing one's own inevitable death. Not facing one's own inevitable death, not acknowledging. This is maybe the ultimate self-deception as a form of denial, the denial of our inevitable death. Who doesn't do that? Who can face moment by moment? Who can face our inevitable death? Who has the capacity to live constantly with that awareness? Well, maybe no one. That would be an extraordinary way of going through your days and nights, is with that awareness. But we don't have to be thinking about our eventual death to face death in the broad sense. Death, there are many forms of death. There's death, it really means the loss of self, loss of our attachment to our own self-image. So every time we find ourselves arguing with someone, or certainly being confronted by someone, we are, in a very real sense, confronting death. Confronting the self and its attachment, our attachment to the self. Confronting the self and its grip on the mind, self and other. Here's the third one. Discriminating others right and wrong while not acting properly oneself. Well, this is self-evident. It becomes more and more evident the longer we practice Zen, is our quickness to judge other people and letting ourselves off the hook. Finding blame in other people and exonerating ourselves of responsibility in situations of conflict. But soon enough, we come to see that we can't be judging other people without judging ourselves. at first, it's when we begin practice, certainly when we begin going to Sesshin, we are alarmed by how judgmental we are of other people. But then we come to see that we're judging ourselves in the same way. So it's kind of a package deal. If we're judging others, you can be sure you're judging yourself. If you're judging yourself, you can be sure you're judging others. The problem is the judging, the attachment to right and wrong. The fourth one is suffering from want and not knowing how to avoid it. So that is not knowing how to deal with our cravings. And there's so many cravings for consumer goods, craving for shopping, course, sex, sleep, food. Well, we touched on this a little earlier about recognizing that a big feature of desire is thoughts and images about the object of our desire. If we're not clinging to thoughts and images, then we're finding a way to manage those desires. Number fifth one says that the ways that people are always wrong, things that are always wrong about, is thinking that original nothingness is nothing. Here we need to distinguish between the Buddhist concept of shunyata, which has been translated as nothingness, no thingness, emptiness, the void, between that and the notion of nothing that stands apart from everything else. That's not when he says original nothingness, he's talking about shunyata, which does not stand apart from everything. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. The sixth one, setting up something in the way of enlightenment. Basically, this means having thoughts about enlightenment, having notions about enlightenment, having opinions. Making enlightenment a goal that we cling to in the mind. Dividing the world into the enlightened and the unenlightened. This is all setting up things in with respect to enlightenment. Our time is up. We come to the end of a section here, and our time is up, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows. Without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions, I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.